It's appropriate we begin this morning with a mechanical failure because, and there may be more as we go along, given the look of the sky and the recent blackout that just took place. It's appropriate because as all mechanisms eventually will fail, I want to begin looking at the Paradiso by talking about inadequacy. And it's something that will lead us into the poem, oddly enough. The Paradiso is the least often read of the three parts of the Inferno, of the Divine Comedy. The Inferno is the most read, and then the Purgatorio, but very few venture into the Paradiso. It is not that it is more difficult than the others. It is not that the poetry is any the lesser. In fact, it is acknowledged by almost all that the poetry of the Paradiso is the most magnificent of the three. It is not that there is any sort of failure of imagination, because Dante, in reaching to describe what heaven itself is like, really outdoes himself. The problem is our inability, I think, to grasp what he is doing, and the fact that we prefer the more grotesque images of the Inferno. We somehow can feel closer to the sufferings of purgatory than we can to grasping the idea of heaven as it is presented to us. I have always found the Paradiso very difficult to talk about. I came very close this morning to taking the coward's way out. I was going to come in and do a modern class for you. I was going to pretend this was a modern school, a modern classroom, and I was going to be a modern professor, and I was going to walk in and come up here. And when we began, I was going to say, well, tell me what you thought of the Paradiso. Did you like the Paradiso? Did you not like the Paradiso? Tell me how the Paradiso made you feel. And then that would go on for about an hour, and you would all have a chance to blah, blah, blah a bit. And I would stand up here and nod nicely and say, that's very nice. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, you don't like it. Oh, that. Tell me why it made you feel that way. Well, why did it make you feel that way? Let's get to the core of this. Where does that feeling come from? What in the poem arouses? And over the space of 2 hours, we could get absolutely nothing done. But I wouldn't have any burden on me. You could have flapped your mouths a bit, and we all could have pretended we did the Paradiso. That was going to be my coward's way up, but I can't do it. So instead, let me look at the beginning of the Paradiso to show you the problem as presented by Dante himself. And then I'm going to try to give you a sense where this peculiarity, this sense of failure when we approach this work comes from. Opening of Canto 1, very beginning of the poem. What is happening, of course, is that we are about to soar upward. Having climbed Mount Purgatory, having made it to the earthly paradise, having crossed those streams, indeed, at the end of the Purgatorio, the last vision is soaring upwards to the stars, and that's where we're going to begin the Paradiso. Canto 1, the glory of the One who moves all things penetrates all the universe, reflecting in one part more and in another less. I have been in his brightest shining heaven and seen such things that no man, once returned from there, has wit or skill to tell about. For when our intellect draws near its goal and fathoms to the depths of its desire, the memory is powerless to follow. But still, as much of heaven's holy realm as I could store and treasure in my mind shall now become the subject of my song. And he begins. Most of the major themes of the entire poem are presented there. But you'll notice that what we get at the beginning is that sense of inadequacy. The poet begins his poem by saying, I'm not up to this task. I can't do it. I have been there. I returned. But No man who has had this vision and come back has wit or skill to tell about. So that curiously, as the poet begins his ascent into paradise, what he is most aware of is the distance between what he wishes to do and what he's able to do. The poem, in one way, is about the inadequacy of man in the face of God. And he presents it poetically by talking about the inadequacy of the poet in attempting to describe the glories of God and God's dwelling place, which is what the Paradiso is. Let me put it another way. In entering the Paradiso, we are entering perfection. God is perfect. God is all perfect. So that the poet has been granted a vision of perfection. He has gone there and he has seen that which very few have ever seen. And that perfection and the fact that he will meet all these souls who are there is a great victory. It is an extraordinary victory. If the Inferno is a failure, an immense failure on the part of human souls within the construct of all that is, if the Purgatorio is that place of suffering where souls have come to begin to understand their own inadequacy and are making that climb, attempting to reach that glorious realm where God dwells, the Paradiso is perfection. Is perfection itself, the perfection of victory. Those souls who are there have done it. They have arrived. But in coming back down and recording it, the poet is admitting defeat. If the vision he has seen is perfection, he must now, through the mirror of language, attempt to render it, and language, even the greatest poetry, is inadequate in the face of the glory of God. So that we begin with a failure, an admission on the part of the poet. I can't write this poem. I cannot do this poem. And then, of course, he goes on to write magnificent poetry, but all the way through, and it rings throughout the poem. The poet has this sense of inadequacy. Now, I want you to look back again, the very first canto, the very first tercet of the first canto. The glory of the one who moves all things. This unity is going to be everywhere in this poem. I have spoken earlier of the way in which everything in this great poem, the Divine Comedy, is rendered in threes. We have the three sections of the poem itself, the Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso. We have each of those essentially 33 cantos, with the one introductory canto at the beginning. We have the verse form itself in terms of the threes, the three-line stanzas, okay? Everything in the whole poem rendered in threes. And I mentioned how the Inferno is divided into three main sections. The Purgatorio is divided into three main sections. And curiously, so is the Paradiso, but we don't notice it in the same way. We can find that rendering, we can get the structure of threeness, but the threeness has become one. The wholeness is there now, and as we soar up through the heavens, what we are being given is a vision of unity, the glory of the one. And once we enter that one, the dwelling place of the three in one, it's not the three that is emphasized, it's the oneness, it's the wholeness. I will give you that structure in just a moment. It's as complex as the other parts. Although difficult in a way to see. The glory of the one who moves all things, okay? Now, as we're soaring upward, where we're going, is eventually the Empyrean where the Trinity itself, dwells. And we'll get a glimpse of that. First, we have to move through the nine spheres as we head upward. And at the top, the ninth sphere, the ninth heaven, if you will, is the prima mobile. That which moves all things, that perfection, that ultimate sphere that causes the other inferior spheres to move. Let me just say that notice Dante, in describing in devising the entire Divine Comedy, took that which was known in his own time. There is the sense that clearly when we're going down into the Inferno, we're somehow moving into the bowels of the earth. It's an imaginary place, but we are sinking downward. the fire, the stone, the harshness, the dangerous climb downward is a vision of climbing into the very center of the earth, which turns out not to be fire but ice when we hit its core. When we climb up Mount Purgatory, we are on an island in the southern hemisphere, and we are going up an actual mountain. And when we get to the Paradiso, we will soar upward through the heavens as they were known to the medieval mind. He will actually use what was known astronomically at that time in order to describe the heavens. At the center, of course, being the earth, and then we move outward from there. But what is moving all the heavens is that one, the glory of the one, penetrates all the universe, reflecting in one part more and in another less. And there is, if you will, the central theme of, again, the Paradiso, the way in which God's grace works throughout the universe. In order to describe this, I want to start by moving to the first sphere, if you will, the first heaven, which comes in Canto 2. If we begin on the earth, even when we've climbed Mount Purgatory and we hit the earthly paradise, we're still on the earth. We're at the highest point on the earth. We're at the best of the earth. We're going to soar beyond the earth instantly, and Beatrice is the one who will make it possible. At the end of Canto 1, she turns her gaze up towards the heavens. She is looking upward, and they are about to move upward. They are on the verge of the first heavenly sphere, which is the moon. We start out at the moon. But before we get there, we get a very curious astronomical discussion. I sincerely think that one reason many people don't make it through the Paradiso is because of Canto 2, which is so peculiar. I think many people are intimidated or puzzled and simply give up there. Let me explain what's going on in Canto 2. Dante begins ascending. They reach the sphere of the moon. They're taken into it. And the first question Dante asks, having entered paradise, is a kind of basic scientific question. Something that apparently we know had puzzled mankind for centuries, and he wants the answer now. And that is, what are those spots on the moon? You go out in the night sky when there is a full moon and you look up at the moon, and he's sometimes called the man in the moon because some people thought those spots on the moon made a face. All you have to do is look up and you can see there are those areas of shade on the moon and the area of bright light. And this is the first thing he wants to know about. And Beatrice explains this to him at length. I'm not going to go through it. Let's just say she's comparing the moon with other spheres. She explains where the light comes from. And then says, you've completely misunderstood it. She said, what you have are areas of light and dark. You have been assuming that somehow there's something there that is causing this, when in fact what you are seeing is the nature of light itself. I'm turning to the very end of Canto 2. I'm at line 124. This is the end of her explanation. And the explanation up to this point is filled with medieval science, which can put us off. It can be puzzling. We've gone beyond it. We know more now, scientifically. And now mark well the path that I take up to reach the truth you seek, so that henceforth you will know how to take the ford alone. The power and motion of the sacred spheres must by the blessed movers be inspired, just as the hammer's art is by the smith. That heaven whose beauty shines with countless lamps from the deep mind that turns it, takes its stamp and of that image makes itself the seal. That is, the moon is receiving light from the source of light. And as the soul within your living dust diffuses through your body's different parts, adapted to its various faculties, just so does this intelligence unfold its bounty, which the stars have multiplied, while turning ever in its unity. Let me pause there briefly. We have in us a living soul. You can call that light. Okay? She is making the point that that light permeates our being, but the fact of the matter is, it shines differently in some areas than in the others. The amount of light reflected by my fingernail is not equivalent to the light reflected in my eye. My fingernail would not be on my finger if the divine light had not permeated my being. That fingernail would not grow. I wouldn't have to clip it every couple of weeks. And the fact that there is growth there, the fact that it exists at all and has being, is because that I have been infused by the Creator. At the same time, no one can doubt that looking into the eye provides us much more of a gateway into a larger truth. Now, it might be possible for a great mystic to meditate for all of eternity on the beauty of the fingernail. It's possible. But for most of us, we need to look into the eye of another human being or understand that light contained in our own eye, okay? So the glory is reflected more and less. Less in the fingernail, but it's still glory. More in the eye. It is greater glory. Different virtues mingle differently with each rich stellar body that they quicken, even as the soul within you blends with you. True to the glad nature from which it flows, this blended virtue shines throughout that body as happiness shines forth through living eyes, and from this virtue, not from dense and rare, derive those differences of light we see. This is the formal principle that gives, according to its virtue, dark and light. Okay? You have been assuming that there was something on the moon itself causing darkness and lightness. You were thinking it was something there in terms of the makeup of the moon. You're wrong, she says. In a way, it's curious because modern science now says, well, it's these craters. There's these gigantic craters and they cast shadows. And Beatrice is saying, no. It has to do with the source of the light and how much light is given. How much light is given. And some places on the moon receive more and therefore lighter, others receive less. Now, what's this doing here? This is there because we are beginning to ascend the heavens and it is the vision of the entire paradiso. And I will go back again to the opening canto which says, penetrates all the universe, reflecting in one part more and in another less. The fact of the matter is we are going to be soaring up to the high Empyrean and get that final vision at the end, first of the unfolding rose, where all of the saints who are with God surround him in this opening rose forever and spend eternity in contemplation of this grand mystery. They are one. Just as you can take a petal of a rose and it is unique in and of itself, you put all the petals together and you have something even more beautiful. And in eternity, this rose is constantly opening outward. It is constantly, constantly unveiling itself. And there is a place there for all the souls who are intended ever to be there. Each one has its special seat. We're going to find that out because Beatrice, when she leaves the pilgrim, when Beatrice finally leaves Dante, goes to her seat. She has an assigned seat and she has to go back to it, okay? And that notion is tell people this is important. There is assigned seating in heaven, according to Dante, okay? You've got your place. It's on the ticket stub, which means you better have the ticket and be ready to go when the time comes. That's the vision. However, those souls are there constantly. They are always there. But in order for Dante to understand where he is going, and the differences in grace possessed by those souls, the light of God is shining downward through the universe and projecting those souls downward. So that those souls with the least grace are going to be on the first sphere. They, in fact, are on the moon, if you will. And they are visually distant from God, they're just in the first sphere, but the fact of the matter is they're not really there when Dante encounters them. When the pilgrim talks to them, they are still in their place on that rose. But God is granting him a vision, and in order for Dante to understand the vision, he has to meet these souls in the nine ascending spheres as we move up through the heavens. It's for that reason, and you will find this, that the paradiso, is the least substantial of the poems. The paradiso is appropriately enough all light, all motion, it is all dance, it is not graspable in physical imagery the way the other two poems have been. This is also a difficulty. It is easier for us to grasp, if you will, the fire in hell, or the river of boiling blood, or the souls with the heavy rocks on their back, than it is to understand a dancing light out of which a voice comes. It is less substantial, and our mind can't quite grab a hold of it. But those lights that we see, and the intensity of that light, has to do with the amount of grace in those blessed souls. Now, does this mean that there are souls that are separated from God, that are lesser somehow, that are so far removed from God in one sense, even in heaven, that they are at all unhappy about it? And he deals with that instantly. Canto 3. Because if he's making that claim, then the possibility could be that there is a problem here. I only made it to the moon, okay? The amount of grace of my soul only got me to the first sphere of heaven. That's all the further I got. And I know for a fact there are souls in the ninth sphere. And he deals with it instantly by introducing to us, again, a young woman named Picarda. Please notice at the beginning of the poem, this time it's Canto 3, but we have a young woman who speaks to us. This is the pattern continuing, opening of the poem, early on the pilgrim meets a young woman. In the Inferno, it's Francesca. In the Purgatory, La Pia. And now here it's Picarda. So he's continuing this pattern. And she explains what happened to her. Those on the moon are the breakers of vows. They're the ones who made vows and didn't keep them. Each of the spheres of heaven also has an angelic order overseeing it. And here the breakers of vows are overseen by the angels. I'll run through these. I'll give you the delineation in a moment. But in any case, it's an angelic sphere. She admits she was in the convent. She was stolen out of the convent, okay? From the world I fled as a young girl to follow her, and in her habit's rule I closed myself and pledged to always follow in her practice. Then men, acquainted less with love than hate, took me by force away from that sweet fold, and God alone knows what my life became. Okay? And the point was, the moment came late in life, she could have gone back and she didn't. She stayed in the world. Nevertheless, hers is a soul in the state of grace. God knows how it happened to her, but she's on the first sphere. And Dante asks quite openly, I'm at line 64, but tell me, all you souls so happy here, do you yearn for a higher post in heaven, to see more, to become more loved by him? You're in heaven, but you're at the bottom of heaven. Would you like to climb up higher? Now, of course, please notice that part of this is indeed still the pilgrim who is possessed with enough worldliness that he has a hint of pride in him still, okay? It certainly is not, he's not making the gross mistakes he made when he went down into the inferno. But the pilgrim still has something to learn here. It's a little bit, gee, wouldn't you like to be up closer to God? Wouldn't he love you more if you were higher up? She gently smiled, as did the other shades. There are other whirling lights around him, okay? The other shades there, they all grin at this foolish man. Then came her words so full of happiness, she seemed to glow with the first fire of love. Brother, that's very nice. Brother, the virtue of our heavenly love tempers our will, and makes us want no more than what we have. We thirst for this alone. Okay? Just don't be silly. Don't be silly. We want what God gives us. We don't want anything more. If we desired to be higher up, then our desires would not be in accord with His will, who assigns us to this sphere. This is where God put me. I'm delighted to be here. My will in accord with His will. This is where I belong. He knows best. I'm quite happy. Think carefully what love is, and you'll see such discord has no place within these rounds. The circular image everywhere, okay? We're in spheres. We're in circles. We have whirling lights. I'll get to it in a moment. We have whole conjunctions of souls that are lights that just whirl around in a dance. We'll meet some of them. You know some of them. Such discord has no place within these rounds, since to be here is to exist in love. Indeed, the essence of this blessed state is to dwell here within His holy will, so that there is no will but one with His. The order of our rank from height to height throughout this realm is pleasing to the realm, as to that King who wills us to His will. The next words, many believe, are the key to the whole divine comedy. This is line 85, canto 3. In His will is our peace. It is the sea in which all things are drawn, that it itself creates, or which the work of nature makes. And the whole function and purpose of our being is to place our will in accord with God's will and thus find peace. In His will is our peace, says Picard. Glorious moment. Question is answered. Gently. The pilgrim learns, okay, I'm going to be soaring upward. I'm going to meet various souls in various spheres. They're all happy. Because in one sense, they all are perpetually around God in that unfolding rose. He is just seeing them in terms of the amount of grace God has chosen to give them. Now, here's something interesting. There is very clearly presented in the Paradiso a sense of predestination. If throughout the Inferno and the Purgatorio we have seen free will in operation, what we see in the Paradiso is that mystery that we cannot understand here, that free will and predestination both exist. And there is a dividing line somewhere, and it seems to Dante to be as we soar up into paradise. Because once we hit paradise, these souls have been given grace by God to get them where they are. And they have been given a specific amount of grace. And that grace increases as we move up through the nine spheres. There is a varying capacity of the blessed souls for taking in the grace, but God also bestows that grace in different degrees. And there's a kind of perfection of order here as well. Now, let me give you a quick rundown or sketch of the entire Paradiso. We again have three sections, if you will. We have the lower heavens, the first three spheres, the moon, Mercury, and Venus. On the moon, the breakers of vows, those who live good lives, who died in the state of grace, but at some point had broken a vow. On the second sphere, Mercury, the lovers of glory, okay? Hint of pride in them, we'll meet some of them, but not real pride, okay? That's been washed away, but lovers of glory. And, of course, the third sphere, Venus, lovers, okay? Those who were filled with love on earth. Now, the three orders of angels overseeing these, just angels on overseeing the moon, the archangels on Mercury, and the principalities overseeing the sphere of Venus. What these three spheres have in common comes through the angels. Those angels are constantly singing the praises of God in the person of the Holy Spirit. Okay, so that in a sense that those three spheres are bound together into lower heavens in that those angels sing the praise of God as the Holy Spirit. Now, we move up to the next three, the middle heavens, if you will. First, we come upon the sun itself. That's circle four, sphere four. And there we find the theologians. We're going to take some time and look at that. It's marvelous. The angels overseeing them there, the powers, okay? Next, sphere five, Mars. It's the realm of the martyrs and the crusaders. And there the virtues are the angels who are overseeing them. And finally, Jupiter, sphere six, the righteous rulers. Those who are righteous rulers on earth, and they're overseen by the dominions. Those three, those sets of angels, overseeing the middle heavens, the powers, the virtues, and the dominions, are constantly singing the praises of God in the person of the Son. Draws them together. The middle heavens are drawn together in that way. And finally, the upper heavens, the last three, Saturn, the contemplatives. Saturn, the realm, the sphere of the contemplatives, overseen by the thrones. Eight, the fixed stars, those unmoving stars, according to Dante, those stars that never move in the heavens. It's the realm, it's the sphere of the triumph of Christ, and the cherubim are there. And finally, the prima mobile, the ninth sphere, that which encircles all and makes all move. That's where the nine orders of angels themselves reside. It's the angelic sphere. The perfect sphere, and it's ruling over all the angels, the seraphim. 7, 8, and 9, the upper heavens, Saturn, the fixed stars, and the prima mobile are over. All those angels are singing the praises of God the Father. Now, as I said earlier, these all connect together. They are one in a sense, more so than any of the other realms, purgatory or the inferno. So there is union there. There is perfection as we move upward. And then finally, when we get to the very end, before we get the final vision of God in the Imperium, we see the unfolding rose. That is just outside the ninth sphere. It's the realm of God Himself. Okay. Now, I want to look at a couple of these spheres in particular. On the way, however, I want to look at one other passage often taken as a central passage in explaining the entire work. Canto 10, the opening of Canto 10. Canto 1 opens with praise of the glory of the One who moves all things. The first nine cantos of the poem take us through the lower heavens. Okay? I'm skipping over this very quickly. I apologize. We go from the moon to Mercury to Venus, and then at the opening of Canto 10, we're about to soar upward again into the middle heavens. We're about to reach the sphere of the sun. The pilgrim is not aware that he's even rising. He will suddenly find himself in the sphere of the sun. But as he moves, his thoughts turn specifically toward the sun, okay? And Canto 10 begins, looking upon his son with all that love which each of them breathes forth eternally, that uncreated, ineffable first one has fashioned all that moves in mind and space in such sublime proportions that no one can see it and not feel his presence there. Look up now, reader, with me, to the spheres. Look straight to that point of the lofty wheels where the one motion and the other cross. And there begin to revel in the work of that great artist who so loves his art, his gaze is fixed on it perpetually. We have the vision of God now, the Creator, looking at his work, but of course the first thing he looks upon is the Son himself. He has fashioned all that moves, and he loves it all, and we go from the Creator through the Son, the Word, from which all creation proceeded, and then suddenly we're there, And everything is in such sublime proportion, everything makes such sense, that the poet says, no one who is seeing clearly can deny the presence of the Creator. And therefore the call, look up now, reader. And we're to share in that sense of trying to soar upward. Look up now, reader. It is the vision, it is a medieval vision. But it is part and parcel of the greatness of the medieval mind. And that is, everything there speaks of God. Everything that surrounds us speaks of God. And if we are not seeing it, it is an inadequacy of our own sight. Ours is the problem. All the way through the Paradiso, that orderliness that was disguised from us often in the other realms is made very clear. And it is an order of great, great beauty. We come to the sun, and we meet the realm, in the realm of the sun, the theologians, the souls of the wise and learned. And suddenly what happens, Dante and Beatrice are surrounded by this circle of lights spinning around them. And it's a problem for Dante the Pilgrim all the way through, because the higher up they get, the more difficulty he has seeing. Okay? The light is intensifying and growing brighter the higher up into these realms that he goes, and his sight is failing simply by the inability of his eye to take it in. And this is going to become a problem until finally as he hits the very top, he is so dazzled, he can still see, but it's extraordinarily difficult. I'm jumping ahead, but I'll give this now. There's the image finally of light being reflected in mirrors. The orders of the angels, when we finally get there, are depicted as mirrors, and they're reflecting God's light. But as if you were to fill a room with mirrors, and then put floodlights in it, so that the mirrors are just reflecting that light, the light would become unbearable. You wouldn't be able to look at it because of its intensity. You've probably all had that sensation where often in winter, you will go out on a sunny day, and the sun reflecting off the snow creates such brilliance that you have to shut your eyes. And you're quite literally blinded by the light. It happens. It happened to me a summer ago, and the first time I climbed up to the roof of Milan Cathedral, which if you ever get to Milan, be sure to take the climb up to the roof. The amount of statuary up there is astonishing, and the statues are completed not just to the outside, but also inside, intending people to climb up and see them. But the top is just covered with marble as well. I was up there on a bright sunshiny day, and I couldn't see. I was literally blinded because the marble was reflecting the sun that then was bouncing off the statues all around. It was absolutely overwhelming. If I had tumbled off the edge, I would have been quite happy at that moment. But the fact that the light was simply blinding. This is what happens to Dante as he goes upward. And he gets in the presence of these lights, and of course part of it is when these 12 surround him, he can barely look at them, and then they won't stay still. They just keep whirling around. Now, this is quite nice. This is part of that sense of unity. In Canto 11, St. Thomas himself speaks, okay? St. Thomas is one of these lights that's whirling around Dante and Beatrice. And at this moment, in Canto 11, St. Thomas, the Dominican, tells the life story of St. Francis. In Canto 12, St. Bonaventura, the Franciscan, will tell the life story of St. Dominic. There's this wonderful sense of unity there, okay? And it's a compliment, in a sense, that they are paying. That having gotten to heaven, the Dominican understands perfectly the glory of St. Francis and can relate it to us. And the Franciscan St. Bonaventura fully understands the greatness that was St. Dominic, and he's the one who relates it to us. I just want to pause. I want to look briefly at this because it's beautifully done. Canto 11, beginning with line 49. We get this glory of created nature. He places St. Francis in an earthly landscape. It's quite beautiful. But then says, born on this slope where steepness breaks the most, our sun rose to the world as radiantly as this sun here does sometimes from the Ganges. Thus, when this town is named, let none call it Assisi, for the word would not suffice. Much more precise a word is Orient. Please notice that St. Thomas himself begins telling this story and finds human language inadequate, down to the naming of towns. Okay, Orient, of course, also containing within it the notion of pearl, something that is so precious, so beautiful. And, of course, what we have at that moment again, that which is white, that which is circular, like the lights themselves whirling around them. Only a few years after he had risen did his invigorating powers begin to penetrate the earth with a new strength. He is describing St. Francis as a sun. Okay? The town he comes from shouldn't be called Assisi, it should be called the Orient, pearl image. And now we get the saint himself who is described as a sun. All of these things become interchangeable. And the story is told us by St. Thomas, who is a whirling light that is spinning around Dante and Beatrice as he tells the story. This is what I mean by the power of imagination. There are times this poem is just simply too much to take in. It is not just a quick glimpse, as in the Inferno, of souls in a river of blood that are trying to come to the top and the centaurs keep knocking them back under the... You know, that's quick. We can grab that. We like that. That's good. What's happening here is happening on so many levels and so quickly that the mind can barely absorb it. It's one reason why this is the part of the work most beloved by poets. It's here that Dante's imagination really took off. And you will hear poets praise the other parts, but they love the Paradiso. He did something exceptional here. The challenge was the greatest, and he met it. While still a youth, he braved his father's wrath because he loved a lady to whom all would bar their door as if to death itself. We're going to get this weird description as if we're talking about a love affair. And at first, it has to be reader along with the pilgrim thinking, what is he talking about? Okay, what is going on here? Of course, what we're getting is love, that love that fills the heavens. And there can only be pure love. We're going to find out. Well, let's go on. Before the bishop's court at Coram Patre, he took this lady as his lawful wife. Who? St. Francis? What is this man talking about? From day to day, he loved her more and more. Bereft of her first spouse, despised, ignored, she waited 1,100 years and more, living without a lover till he came. The confusion is great now, okay? St. Francis married a very old lady, 1,100 years old. But, of course, the pilgrim is listening with human ears. We're reading with human intelligence, and it's failing. We're back to what I said earlier. This poem is about the failure of us to grasp the glories. Living without a lover till he came alone, though it was known that she was found with Amyclus, secure against the voice, which had the power to terrify the world. Alone, though known was her fierce constancy, that time she climbed the cross to be with Christ, while Mary stayed below alone. Enough of such illusions. In plain words, it's sort of, I'm sure St. Thomas at that moment sees the puzzlement on the face of the pilgrim. What is he talking about? Enough of such illusions. In plain words, take Francis now and poverty to be the lovers in the story I have told. Their sweet accord, their faces spread with bliss, the love, the mystery, their tender looks, gave rise in others' hearts to holy thoughts. And on it goes. The union of Saint Francis with Lady Poverty. There is a sense as we soar upward, the saints themselves that we meet are going to become symbols of large ideas. The individual lived life is important, but once the saint attains heaven, the vision is going to be of there is a lesson to be learned from that life. And the life of the saint becomes representative of something much greater. We get it, and we get it all the way through. Now, we get the story of St. Francis, and then something curious happens. St. Thomas turns back to the Dominicans for a moment. And begins criticizing I'm at line 119. Finishes the story of St. Francis and says, "Think now what kind of man were fit to be his fellow helmsman on St. Peter's boat, keeping it straight on course in the high sea. And such a steersman was our patriarch." He's speaking of St. Dominic, who founded his own order. So now he's shifting back to talk about himself. "And those who follow his command will see the richness of the cargo in their hold." St. Dominic is put the ship together, he stored the ship, and some of us are lucky enough to be on that ship. "But his own flock is growing greedy now for richer food. And in their hungry search, they stray to alien pastures carelessly. The farther off his sheep go wandering from him in all directions, the less milk they bring back when they come back to the fold. True, there are some who, fearing loss, will keep close to their shepherd. But so few are these, it would not take much cloth to make their cowls. Now, if my speech has not been too obscure, and if you have been listening carefully, and if you will recall my former words," please know this is wonderful. The obligations on the pilgrim as listener here. And St. Thomas says, "I've given you a lot, but okay, these are the conditions under which you'll understand. If my speech hasn't been too obscure, and I became plainer as I went along. Two, if you've been listening, and three, if you've bothered to remember what I've told you. Your wish will have been satisfied in part." I love it. "If you did everything you were supposed to do, then you will have a partial satisfaction. Incompleteness, failure on the part of the pilgrim, who at the best will only get a glimpse of what he's been told. For you will have seen how the tree is chipped, and why I made the qualifying statement, where all may fatten if they do not stray." Critical of his own order. I want to leap ahead to the end of Canto 12. Near the end of Canto 12, we get something very similar. Saint Bonaventura has given to us the life story of Saint Dominic, but near the end of the canto, he criticizes the Franciscans. And again, there is a criticism built in. By the way, I failed to mention, Saint Bonaventura is not one of the original 12. Suddenly, a second set of 12 whirling lights comes. So we have the pilgrim and Beatrice in the middle, surrounded by 12 whirling lights. Saint Thomas, the others are introduced, by the way. I'm not taking the time to do it. And then a second circle surrounds them. And these circles are whirling in opposite directions, and in the middle, the pilgrim, whose head is probably spinning as well. And then Saint Bonaventura speaks from the outer circle of whirling lights and tells this story. At the end, he criticizes his own order, okay? "I will admit that if you search our book page after page, you might find one that reads, 'I still am now what I have always been.' If you go through our order, you might still find a dedicated Franciscan. But such cannot be said of those who come from Aqua Sparta or Casale and read our rule too loosely or too narrowly. There are too many people becoming Franciscans who are making their own decision about how this order is going to be established and what's going on here." I want to point out this is a theme running throughout the entire Paradiso. What we have here is a sense, again, of the failure. These great saints have come and participated in the glory of these religious orders, and now they look down, and what they're seeing on earth is failure, collapse, the breaking apart, the inadequacy of those souls who remain on the earth. Now, part of this, clearly, is Dante giving social criticism, which he does throughout the poem. But there is also, let me put it this way. As we rise through the heavenly spheres coming toward the moment of the final vision of God himself, as, if you will, the end of the entire pilgrimage is approaching, the poem and the poet and those saints he meets become obsessed with beginnings. There is a seeming contradiction here. But It is also logical, again, if you look at the principal poetic images that underlie the poem. From the beginning, we have the vision of the divine light coming from the source of light and permeating everything in all of creation. There is a phrase that is used. It comes again from the very first canto of the whole work. Penetrates all the universe, reflecting back. Penetra e resplende. Okay? Now, problem of translation. This translator uses reflecting, which is good, but resplende means, quite literally, to glow again, to offer new splendor. So the vision is of divine light going from the Creator going out into all of creation, and then if the creation fulfills its purpose, if its will is God's will, that light comes back to heaven, glowing more intensely. It re-glows as it comes back. And hence, it is that very light returning that should draw all things to God. Thus, the divine light, if you will, pours out into creation, into the multiplicity of creation, and seeks by that light to return the creature to its creator. As a result of this, there is an obsession with beginnings and endings in this poem. The beginning of the light, the source of the light, God himself. But then, the moment when the creature grasps the fullness of creation and seeks to return to its creator. And hence, for example, the theologians talk about the founding of these orders. The description of the life of St. Francis, the description of the life of St. Dominic, with the recognition that from that glorious moment, from that starting point when there were these great souls who returned to God in the splendor because their will was his will, we now over time have seen the deterioration. And what is there now? Not as great. Compromises, failures, inadequacy, human error, and we get on one level social criticism, but on another level the recognition of the failure of man, the inadequacy of man. Who will settle, who will not be willing to return to his creator, who does not want to make the return. And it's interesting and appropriate that whereas St. Thomas tells the tale of St. Francis, he will criticize the Dominicans. They're his order, he knows them best. While St. Bonaventura tells the story, the life of St. Dominic, he will then criticize the Franciscans. These are his people. This is his order. And he realizes what a falling off there has been. Now, what I'm going to do, it's an extraordinary moment later in the poem, I'm setting you up for this, is the moment when St. Peter looks down on Rome. It's too good to toss away in the couple of minutes I have left. But what I'm doing is setting up a pattern here that runs throughout the poem, and you will find it everywhere. What you need to do is you look at that, and you'll keep coming upon this as you read the Paradiso, is understand this is not just social criticism in Dante's own time. It has to do with the struggle by which our will becomes his will. And the fact that being human, the tendency is to turn away from the light, not to understand the source of the light, not to let that light that is in us, and I prefer the word, re-glow back towards the Creator, as it's supposed to, and as it has in the great saints that the pilgrim is meeting as he rises up, sphere by sphere, through these orders. I'll stop there for now. I'll pick up with the martyrs and the crusaders.